welcome everyone to the United Lodge of Theosophists here in Philadelphia. We are but one of many around the world that put forth these ideas of universal brotherhood as put forth by the founders of the Theosophical movement back in 1875. We are all bound by one declaration. No matter which meeting you would go to in the world, you will always hear these inspiring words. The policy of this lodge is independent devotion to the cause of theosophy without professing attachment to any theosophical organization. It is loyal to the great founders of the Theosophical movement, but does not concern itself with dissensions or differences of individual opinion. The work it has on hand and the end it keeps in view are too absorbing and too lofty to leave it the time or inclination to take part in side issues. That work and that end is the dissemination of the fundamental principles of the philosophy of theosophy and the exemplification and practice of those principles through a truer realization of the self, a profounder conviction of universal brotherhood. It holds that the unassailable basis for union among theosophists, however and how, wherever and however situated, is similarity of aim, purpose, and teaching, and therefore has neither constitution, bylaws, nor officers, the sole bond between its associates being that basis. And it aims to disseminate this idea among theosophists in the furtherance of unity. It regards as theosophists all who are engaged in the true service of humanity without distinction of race, creed, sex, condition, or organization, and it welcomes to its association all those who are in accord with its declared purposes and who desire to fit themselves by study and otherwise to be the better able to help and teach others. The true theosophist belongs to no cult or sect, yet belongs to each and all. So, for this lodge to fulfill these high ideals, we have two meetings a week. As now, on Sundays, we are studying the Epitome of Theosophy by William Q. Judge. And today we're going to be looking at the aspect of theosophy as the wisdom religion. And next week we'll be looking at universal evolution. And just a reminder, we will not be having any Sunday meetings during the month of August. We will continue, of course, with Wednesday, but no Sunday meetings in August. And we just started the Bhagavad Gita last Wednesday, so we'll be continuing in that for the rest of the summer. The book table is open before and after all meetings. The library is open at 5:15 and runs until 7:15. It is a reference library. There is always a student available that can help you with any individual study, and you can prepare for the part for that night. The study class on Wednesday is from 7:30 to 8:30. And on Sundays, the doors open at 10:30, and the class runs from 11 until 12. The lodge is financially sustained entirely by voluntary contributions. Its activities depend similarly on voluntary offerings in time and work. All are invited to participate, but no obligation is imposed or implied. So our class today, we do want to let you know about, here it is. On the book table, there's a printout from The Secret Doctrine, that will be looking over a lot of the ideas that we'll be studying in the Epitome of Theosophy. It will give a totally different perspective of these same ideas. So we urge everyone to pick one up. It's at the book table. Get it after the meeting. So last week, we did a little background on the history of the Epitome, that it was originally issued as the title was a Theosophical Tract, and then Mr. Judge was asked to expound on it, and then it became more of a pamphlet, and now it went and is going by the name of an Epitome of Theosophy. And it is a treasure that we have. It is so concise and so thorough an investigation of what the philosophy is that we think it's almost like with the ocean of theosophy, that one can look at it as a very simple kind of an explanation of the philosophy, but those of us who have studied it every year for many years realize that you can go as deep as you want. And it seems to us that the Epitome is the same way. On the surface, it seems like a very simplistic explanation of the philosophy, but when you keep reading it, it just seems to be, oh, you know, there might be a little bit more to it than what we originally noticed. So today we will have somebody summarize it. The first part, we'll be looking at page 7 to page 11, remaining in the bosom of the Father. And it'll go into a little more specific background of theosophy about the elder brothers, and then we'll be looking at the first proposition. So we'll have somebody come up and do a summary.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to this rendition of the Epitome of Theosophy. And before we begin, we recommend that you stop at the book table and you will find another document there, perhaps, they still have it, a pamphlet called Theosophy Simply Stated. And then when there are enough Epitome copies present, then you pick up one of these. So we're going to begin on page 7. Theosophy. The wisdom religion has existed from immemorial time. It offers us a theory of nature and life which is founded upon knowledge acquired by the sages of the past, more especially those of the East, and its higher students claim that this knowledge is not imagined or inferred, but that it is a knowledge of facts, seen and known by those who are willing to comply with the conditions requisite for seeing and knowing. And it gives us a different theosophy, meaning knowledge of or about God. The theory of nature and life which it offers is not one that was at first speculatively laid down and then proved by adjusting facts or conclusions to fit it, but is an explanation of existence, cosmic and individual, derived from knowledge reached by those who have acquired the power to see behind the curtain that hides the operations of nature from the ordinary mind. Such beings are called sages, using the term in its highest sense. It is not claimed that these exalted beings or sages have existed only in the East. They have known to be lived in all parts of the globe in obedience to the cyclic laws referred to below. But as far as concerns the present development of the human race on this planet, they are now to be found in the East, although the fact may be that some of them had, in remote times, retreated from even the American shores. The following are some of the fundamental propositions of theosophy. The spirit in man is the only real and permanent part of his being, the rest of his nature being variously compounded. And since decay is incident to all composite things, everything in man but his spirit is impermanent. Further, the universe being one thing and not diverse, and everything within it being connected with the whole and with every other thing therein, of which upon the upper plane there is a perfect knowledge. No act or thought occurs without each portion of the great whole perceiving and noting it. Hence, all are inseparably bound together by the tie of brotherhood. The first fundamental proposition of theosophy postulates that the universe is not an aggregation of diverse unities, but that it is one whole. This whole is what is denominated deity by the Western philosophers and Parabrahm by the Hindu Vedantins. It may be called the unmanifested, containing within itself the potency of every form of manifestation, together with the laws governing those manifestations. Further down, the first cause, so-called because it itself is the rootless root of that cause, and called in the East the causeless cause, the first cause may be called, we may call Brahma, or Mazda, or Osiris, or by any name we please. The projection into time of the influence or so-called breath of Brahma causes all the worlds and beings upon them to gradually appear. They remain in manifestation just as long as that influence continues to proceed forth in evolution. After long eons, the outbreathing evolutionary influence slackens, and the universe begins to go into obscuration, or pralaya, until the breath, being fully indrawn, no objects remain, because nothing is but Brahma. Now, care must be taken by the student to make a distinction between Brahma, the impersonal power Brahma, and Brahma, the manifested Logos. A discussion of the means used by this power in acting would be put out of place in this epitome, but of those means theosophy also treats. Now, for the purpose of Iman Vantara, two so-called eternal principles are postulated, that is Purusha and Prakriti, or spirit and matter. Because both are ever-present and conjoined in each manifestation. These terms are used here because no equivalent for them exists in English. Purusha is called spirit, and Prakriti, matter. But this Purusha is not unmanifested, nor is Prakriti, matter as known to science. The Aryan sages therefore declared that there is a higher spirit still called Purushottama. The reason for this is that at the night of Brahma, or the so-called indrawing of his breath, both Purusha and Prakriti are absorbed in the unmanifested, a conception which is the same as the idea underlying the biblical expression, remaining in the bosom of the Father.
Thank you.
As stated, until we get more epitomes, recommend picking up at the desk Theosophy simply stated.
So we, as can be seen, we did get, there are a couple things that we can cover in class. The background of what Theosophy means. We can talk about the elder brothers, the adepts, and then we can talk about manifestation, how the in-breathing and the out-breathing. So it's a short part, but there's quite a bit. So if people would like to ask questions, yes.
The last sentence in the first paragraph says that it is the knowledge of facts seen and known by those students who are willing to comply with the conditions requisite for seeing and knowing. And then also on page 8 at the bottom, it's not possible to respond to the demand of the worldly man for an immediate statement of this wisdom in so much as he could not comprehend it until those conditions are fulfilled. What are the conditions?
All right, so you're talking about the last sentence on the first paragraph, and where was the other part?
I'm sorry, yes. And then the other one was on the bottom of page 8. It says, it is not possible to respond to the demand of the worldly man for an immediate statement of this wisdom, in so much as he could not comprehend it until those conditions are fulfilled. So both are talking about you have to fulfill certain conditions requisite to understand philosophy.
Well, we think some of those are, for one thing, being aware that there are these ideas and that we're looking at the idea of self-induced and self-devised means, that it is on us to study these ideas and being open to, they are very different than what we think any of us have been brought up with. It has been a major mind shift. We hear the term culture shock in regards to moving from different cultures, but we can apply the same idea here because it is so very different from we think what any of us might have been brought up with. And we need to be open to the differences. So we think that karmically a person will need to be ready, that from a past life they have brought with them to a current life what the, how can we put it, that they're bringing to this life a willingness to study, because this is not something that's going to be force-fed to you. It's something that has to be studied. It has to be read. It has to be discussed not only with others but in your own mind and heart. That there's just a big desire for these ideas and the knowledge that it is different from everything else. So in the back.
We think that the idea
louder, please.
Of an epitome of theology, and then in that second paragraph, curiosity, knowledge of or about God, not in the sense of personal anthropomorphic God, but in that of divine, godly wisdom. We think that goes right to the point immediately, so that we have a basic understanding, at least, of what will follow. Knowledge of or about God, not in the sense of a personal anthropomorphic, but in that of divine, godly wisdom.
And we think in regards to that, to the first question, this fits in, because this is a big change that people have to think about, that no, they don't, they not only do they not have to, but they're not really praying to anything, that it has to be an inward experience, and that is a big change for a lot of people, because they've come to rely on an outside God to make those decisions for them, to be a comfort. Now the reliance is on themselves. So in the back?
Well, just, you think you opened the meeting with the very answer, what is the condition? And it is said that the only thing you have to agree with in order to be a student of theosophy is universal brotherhood. If that condition is not there, then all of these teachings are not going to really touch you.
Bringing that up about universal brotherhood, there's an interesting point, if we can find it. Mr. Judge talks about how that we are, that this is not, we're having a hard time finding it. He makes a comment about how that we are not diverse, but we are a unity. And
further, the universe is how it starts.
Well, I'm sorry.
What? It's under the propositions.
Oh. Okay.
The second paragraph under the propositions. Page 9.
Oh, here it is. Thank you. Further, the universe being one thing and not diverse, and everything within it being connected with the whole, and with every other thing therein, of which upon the upper plane there is a perfect knowledge. No act or thought occurs without each portion of the great whole perceiving and noting it. Hence, all are separately bound together, inseparably bound together by the tie of brotherhood. So as was said, this is the only real idea that we need to follow, is this idea of universal brotherhood. I mean, it talks about it in the Declaration as well. And when we look at the first proposition, it talks about what that deific essence is, how we are all a ray of it. And looking at this piece from Mr. Judge, we can see then, can't we, how this whole idea of universal brotherhood is a fact in nature. And I mean, there's so much in the philosophy in our readings that it definitely makes a wonderful study as to how universal brotherhood permeates everything. And it's a piece that has been covered up. It's been thwarted with all the trappings and the dogma of the other religions. So we feel that this is an important piece that is a thread throughout all of the philosophies, this idea. In the back?
So is this where the work begins?
Is this where the work begins then?
Yes, by looking in within yourself and then seeing outward.
The connection, the universal connection with everybody, with everything, that it's all one. why it's so difficult to tread that path?
Well, the whole idea of the self-responsibility, basically, what is being commented on, when we're looking at spiritual ideas, we think everybody's been used to being spoon-fed, that this is what you're supposed to believe. And the philosophy talks about check, testing, and verifying. We are not expected to take things at face value. It's like we are expected to question, because the desire should come within. And if we're not sure what those ideas are, or if we believe in them, then they're not really going to come forth. And the idea of coming forth in respect to universal brotherhood is loving everyone, doing for others, and being kind. The idea of compassion as being, you know, one of the major virtues that is expected. And we have to look at the idea of meditating too, to calm oneself, to open one's mind to the bidding of the higher. Yes.
Also at the bottom of page 8 and page 9, it talks about the demolition of preconceived notions that are either to inadequate or erroneous theories, especially in the Occident, which is us here. And it's interesting because it talks about the ideas of education that have been prevailing. And we think he's talking about Aristotle, when he turned Plato on his head. And, you know, looking at particulars and then trying to universalize from particulars, but we get lost in all the details of the particulars, and science is very speculative. It is, we think, turning around. It has been making a U-turn, as it were, but we still have a lot of that baggage
mm-hmm.
we're still dealing with. And the demolition of ideas, it's funny that the word demolition is used. It's very telling because of the materialism of our thinking, very materialistic thinking. It's like we have to go and just like demolish our preconceived notions in order to, and then there's a vacuum left, of course,
mm-hmm.
and then we become hopefully open to these ideas so that they can permeate.
Yes, this idea of the demolition of one's ideas, again, these ideas are so different from what we've been brought up with, that if one is going to demolish the standard, the familial ideas of spirituality and religion, as was said, there is a space, there's a hole there. And it's interesting, for the most part, it just seems as though humanity seems to need some type of spiritual idea in their lives. We know that there are atheists, of course, but we even think to some extent some of these atheists have something higher than themselves to believe in. And in regards to science, well, there's the whole idea with science of, studying different ideas and speculating and doing research and statistics, all of that. But statistics can be skewed to whoever's doing the study, and they're able to put it towards the idea that they want to find out. Just take, for instance, coffee. What's come around with coffee recently, just as an example. In the past, it was an anathema towards your heart. Now they're saying it's good for your heart, it's good for your mind. So whoever does the research in regards with science, one can't really take science either. You have to question again. Just like with theosophy, we're encouraged to check, test, and verify. So it is very important that everything that we see, we don't take at 100% at first. Follow up?
Yes.
Yes.
Well, it has to do with coffee. The studies that were, and this has to do with thinking too, and the studies that were done on coffee in the past were done at a period where the majority of the population were smokers.
Mm.
Now the majority of the pop, and now there are fewer and fewer smokers, and they think that they conflated the two in a way that, so it had to do with that, just
Well, there's, again, there's a research study that wasn't done properly. So again, you have to question. Yes, in the back.
The remark you made before that was a modern statement of the Buddha, who said, do not believe anything, even if I say it, unless you can verify it in your own experience.
Mm-hmm. Yes, in your own experience, yes. Yes.
Those remarks are in line with what we had in mind when last week we learned that the first edition was sent back to Mr. Jones and said it's a little too steep for the part. And we discovered, well, we know what we will do. We will listen, but we'll put our left hand over our left ear and take it in through the right, and perhaps it'll stop somewhere in the middle. Because most of the time, we read it. It goes in one ear and right out the other. And if you don't believe it, you heard the talk on the Amphibian today. Sometimes this evening, pick up the book before you even tomorrow.
What's that?
Pick up the article again and go over it. And you will discover exactly. Take it in one ear and prevent it from going out, then perhaps it will sink in. So study requires repetition, and in due time, and Mr. Judge knew that.
We had
study will bring out the results.
We had a more experienced student when we first came. And we were bemoaning our inability to understand the secret doctrine. And it was told to us, don't worry if you don't understand it. It makes your mind porous to the movement of your higher nature. So even if we don't understand some of these things, we need to, as was just said, we have to keep studying. Yes?
To refer to the Buddha again, if you read what's recorded of his statements, he would state something and then state it again a little differently.
Mm-hmm.
And it was said that the first time you hear something, you hear it with your brain mind, and it's kind of a ho-hum. But then when it's repeated, your brain goes, I already know that. And you hear it with your spiritual nature. Mm-hmm. So we have two ways of learning, and we should recognize that. So we should read things twice or 20 times.
Yeah, and as was said in the beginning of the meeting, we've, with the Bhagavad Gita especially, it and the ocean, it doesn't matter how many times we read them, and the voice of the silence as well, we seem to always get something different. Yes.
Page 3 of the handout, I guess would be page 9 of the small booklet.
Oh, okay.
And it talks about the breath Brahma creates, causes all the worlds and the beings upon them to gradually appear, they remain in manifestation just as long as that influence continues to proceed forth in evolution. After long eons, the outbreathing evolutionary influence slackens, and the universe begins to go into obscuration until the breath on and on and on. See, I'm missing the part that I wanted to point out.
It's interesting.
It, as long as it's proceeding in evolution forward.
A little louder, please.
As long as evolution is proceeding forward, it remains, but as it begins to slacken, it starts to withdraw the breath. So, does that apply? Can we see that in the particulars as well as in the universal? Like, as in one particular being begins to stop evolutionizing, they start to withdraw and go towards death, I imagine. I don't know what I'm trying to say, but.
So are you looking at comparing the cosmic end of the Manvantara as opposed to a human? If the same sort of thing happens in a smaller scale in a
yes.
human life? Is that what you're asking?
It says they remain in manifestation just as long as that influence continues to proceed forth in evolution. And then after long eons, the influence begins to slacken. So how does that apply in the particular small parts and into the larger perspective? Does anybody have
No,
chance.
Well, we're trying to formulate an answer, so in the meantime.
Well, we think it simply has to do with the life cycle.
Mm-hmm.
So the life cycle on the one hand of a plant is, it's going to proceed and at a certain point it's going to die off, whether it's the annual or the life cycle of it. But that's different from the human being because we have that statement, not from the philosophy, but it's just a common statement. You know, some people think, well, when we get old, we stop growing. But the flip side of that is probably more the truth. When we stop growing, we get old. So the human being has a choice to continue that impulse through life and continue to grow. But the normal cycle, it would seem, for the rest of life, micro and macro, is just, he's talking about that life cycle.
And we also see, and we think it's in the ocean, talks about how races die out when that energy that has been moving these races over the course of time, it's just a natural decline that happens with these races. And then if we're trying to remember the whole process, and then those egos will proceed into other forms. But it's a natural decline of those forms. So it happens, as was said, in regards to plants. So that evolutionary ebb and flow, we can see with the decline in the races, because then that ego goes into something else, whereas that form dies out. And they talk about, we think it's in the countryside, the rural areas of China, and we think with the Aborigines, it's like they're talking about how the females in Australia are able to just kind of shut off procreation, and then eventually they're saying that the Aborigines will disappear as well. Is this a follow-up?
Yeah, it's just like, so that would be, what would be some signs of something going into decline?
Yeah.
Would that be like extinction, going towards extinction, or that's different?
Are you talking about extinction of a race?
Yeah. Yeah, or anything. Anything.
Well, if it disappears. But then again, when we're talking about extinction of animals, you know, there's so many other influences, human influences, weather. So who's to say if that would, when an animal goes extinct, if that's considered a natural extinction or not? But we know that there are natural extinctions for humans, as we were just expressing. Do you want to add?
Well, just that when we say extinction, we're talking about the form, as you pointed out. The race dies out because karmically the lessons have been worn out and the ego needs to move on. But for human extinction, there is a moment in the next period or round of evolution where we have to make a choice. But the choice is really made up of all the choices we've been making all along. It is, will you have the power to be able to proceed in the next rounds? Will you have developed the will, the universal brotherhood? So there is a choice in the fifth round, and those who do not or have not the power to go on will be part of that. Well, it's not an extinction. It's a rest that comes early before the others who can go on, hopefully to develop completely. But extinction can never happen to any of life, only the forms.
Mm-hmm. And then that form, will, once it goes back into constituent parts, it can be reused again anyway into something else. But one thing, in regards to that choice, when it was said, are we going to be ready? That goes back to the first question that we had about how do we become ready for these ideas? So we can kind of tie the two things together, because in order to be ready to make the choice in the fifth round, then it's something that we're bringing with us from the choices, as was said, in the past. And then the choice to obtain these ideas and understand them and bring them into our lives. Yes.
So then based on that, then it seems like one of the conditions, you know, it would seem obviously the first one, as we've been saying, is the recognition of universal brotherhood and the willingness to try to prove it to yourself as best one can. But another condition then has to be, if it's your choice, then it must be your responsibility.
Mm-hmm.
So it must be the willingness to take on responsibility for everything about you.
Responsibility for your choices, that is a huge endeavor that we all have to make when we're looking at the idea of karma. And what people don't understand, if they don't believe in karma, or they only believe in karma in this one life, which it seems like there's a lot of people, they say, oh, karma, you know, karma's going to get you. But they're talking about in the future of this life, not necessarily making those changes when we're looking at the dual ideas of karma and reincarnation for a future life. So we do have that responsibility. It's and to ourselves, to our higher nature, that we do take responsibility for what it is that we're choosing. Yes?
Just along the line of universal brotherhood, we should consider the fact that there are many beautiful souls who've never heard the word theosophy, could never say anything about the three fundamentals, but have
mm-hmm.
their heart and mind so completely open that one can only assume they'll be light years ahead of the rest
mm-hmm.
of us who are studying so hard, because they are living from the heart and therefore closer to the reality of life.
Exactly. And we think it's kind of funny in a way, because there are so many uncomfortable things going on now. But at the same time, there are more ideas that are coming out on social media, on the news, of the wonderful things that people are doing. And they're doing it because of love for their fellow. And we never hear of what their spiritual inclinations are. All we know is what they're doing. And it is a beautiful thing to see. And we want to just put out there this, and it's not a controversial subject, but the way the world is coming around these 13 people stuck in the tunnel, which we understand some of them are getting out now, but it has been a wonderful thing, in all these different countries coming together to rescue. And you hear people, oh, what's the latest? And it's a wonderful thing to see that the world finally is coming together around something. One idea. Yes.
The main theory is that, and what we say makes one feel very humble. Our modern times, our educational systems, and so forth. We discover that they deal with the materiality of life. And during the course of that time, we have questions. Why did this happen? What's the story? How should I react to this and that? When we hear the reading from the Epitome, it tells us we're more than what we think of. And then they give us words and terms, and we heard the word step.
Heard what?
The word study.
Study.
Well, we always study. But as we said earlier, it goes in one ear and out the other. If it doesn't have something to do with our material well-being. The minute they speak in terms such as a theory of nature and life, adjusting facts and then we become like a little child. Mm. And we have to repeatedly read until one time something sinks in. And as we said earlier, we put our hand over one ear, and these ideas begin to take root.
Right. And as long as we get one idea that gets stuck in there, we're ahead. There was a hand up in the back.
Well, we're talking about people coming together. If you look back through just modern history, any time there is a crisis for an individual that gets publicized, practically the whole world rushes with advice or help or money. It's when we know we're needed. And often when people are in a crisis like that, they will say the most theosophical thing without realizing it. For God's sake, help me.
Yes. Yes.
Are these ideas implanted in us inherently, and it is our job to resurface them?
It is.
Our birthright, a gift, not a gift, I guess, but a birthright for every soul born?
Yes. If one. I mean, and this is another big study, is the whole idea of evolution going back to the first globe and the first race, that it is said that when we have come over, that we, the elder brothers, have implanted these ideas in us, and when we were ethereal. And then as we think, we don't know if this is right, but then as we became more and more material, and depending upon what our karmic expression would be, then that would determine how deeply we think these ideas have been buried. But they are inherent, and this whole idea of evolution is the experience of the soul in order to open up. When we talk about the mind being porous to be affected by the dictate of the soul. That's what we're trying to do, is to get these ideas in a more, we think, usable frame for our mind to express. Yes.
Well, these inherent ideas, they're in the middle of the, in the midpoint of evolution, when there's a lighting up of Manus, then we start receiving these ideas, because before that, we're not really human. We're not mind beings yet. We're the mindless. So that's when it starts. But it, they have all been impressed.
Yes.
On it. So we're here to unbury it, because we've made the wrong choices all along and gotten enamored in a narcissistic way with ourselves and a materialistic way with matter.
So we can rephrase it maybe that these ideas are inherent in us, but it wasn't until we were actually lit up that we have begun to be able to access them. Yes.
We're identifying with the wrong half, though. We are mind beings who entered forms that had the germ of mind, but no choices of mind. So we must never think we were mindless beings, although spirit and matter are one. So those two sides of our nature are one and the same thing. They're both spiritual, but we, as thinkers, have the duty and responsibility to elevate the mindless within us and therefore influence all of life around us. We think we should remember, at the moment of rebirth, after the digestion of the life just lived, we stand as spiritual beings and we see what is coming, but we know it's completely just and right and fitting for us, and we willingly return to Earth. So it isn't like we're ignorant, it's just that our own language and use of mind and heart prevent us from understanding ourselves even.
It, in regards to that moment of rebirth, we are given this, we have earned it. We have definitely earned the life that's coming. But we also have the choice whether we're going to make it a positive experience for the soul or not. And if it appears to be a positive life of comfortable materialism, people that love us, that type of thing, it's harder, really, to make those good choices, because there's no stress, so to speak, on us to make other changes. We become lackadaisical, and we think it's the unusual soul that may be able to go above and beyond all the comforts that they've been given. Whereas if their struggles, it seems that we may be able to have more of, when we have these choices, when there's struggles, we may be able to make more progress. Yes?
Yeah, but the other side of that is, when we're born into lives with problems seemingly out of our control that are stressing us out, it could well be because in previous lives we should have taken care of it but didn't, and now we don't have a choice. Whereas there may be plenty of people who live some seemingly comfortable lives without a lot of problems, who live according to the law and inherently know certain things to do, when to do it, how to do it, and produce wonderful things in this world, and it's all better for it. And their karma, at least at this stage of the game, is they don't have to deal with these things that can really stress them out. But that's because they've been doing it right, maybe.
Yeah, so, I mean, everybody, of course, has their karmic legacy that they're bringing with them, whether it's for good or if it's for struggle. So, it again, there's that responsibility on all of us to make those right choices, because to fulfill our duty in this life. That's one thing we haven't mentioned yet, is this whole idea of doing what comes to you, and it's your motive and your attitude as to how you react to those, to that duty that comes to you, and this will determine in many respects if you're going to deal with it again in a future life. You had your hand up.
So, yes, we were mind beings that entered mindless forms, but then again, we were instructed by the great rishis and sages who had perfected themselves up to the point that we may someday be able to perfect ourselves in this period of evolution. So, relatively speaking, they were light years ahead of us.
Mm-hmm.
Although we did have that mind principle that the solar petries and the lunar petries came together.
Yes, thank you. Thank you. In the corner there.
So if our being is a microcosm of the macrocosm, and the saying nature unaided fails, so if we don't try to bring light or bring forth that light that's in us, is that, you know, and not trying to understand these ideas, is that failing our instrument that we're in this incarnation? And if we are doing this work, are we raising all the brotherhood that our body is?
Mm-hmm.
You know, macrocosm.
So are we, how, mainly how are we impressing the forms that we're using?
Thank you.
Sure. Yes, I mean, we are told that thoughts are things, that thoughts are powerful. Thoughts can color everything. So if we, and then when the thoughts, not only our physical form, but the astral, gets affected by what we're thinking, what we're talking about, how we're acting, all of that. So depending upon the color of these impressions, if it's a dark heaviness, then these forms will be affected by that. And then when the form deteriorates, this, you know, the dark negative impressions will be going back from their constituent parts as well. But if it's a positive one, we all can feel what it's like to be around somebody who's lighthearted and happy and positive. They're the kind of people that you just want to be around. Whereas if somebody who thinks the opposite, you don't want to be around them. And people can feel. So it's the thoughts and the ideas that will impress all the physicality of these forms. So we are, maybe one quick one?
Oh, just that obstacles are opportunities.
Mm-hmm.
And if you look at all of the great people that we can think of historically, Mandela, Gandhi,
mm-hmm.
everybody that we can think of that made a good impression on the world was in the midst of horrible suffering. So suffering is not a negative thing, but we have to take it as an opportunity.
Great. Thank you. So that's the end of our meeting, and the meeting is over. Thank you.